Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Highway safety officials are concerned about a number of important issues in Vermont. One is the high rate of speeding on the interstate and on back roads. Rich Slusser is a member of the Vermont State Police Traffic Operations Unit, which concentrates on road safety, education, and enforcement. He spends much of his time patrolling the interstate highways. He says his job is much more than just catching speeders and drunk drivers.
I'm looking for a distracted driver, which that's pretty important to me. The people crossing the line, they look just like a DUI driver almost. And I think the stats show they're actually more dangerous than a DUI driver.
Are people driving faster these days? Is distracted driving still an issue for highway officials? And are many drivers happy to share the road with bicyclists? These are just a few of the questions we have for our guest today. Scott Davidson is the chief of the governor's highway safety program, and Lieutenant Gary Scott is the head of the Vermont State Police traffic safety team. Great to have you both here today. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having us.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. What's your experience? Do you think people are driving faster these days, perhaps on the interstate, perhaps on state roads or even town roads? How big of a problem do you think this is? And I'm wondering, do you still see people on their handheld cell phones, even though there's a state law that prohibits this activity? Do you see other types of distracted driving? What are some of the worst examples that you've ever seen? And if you think these issues are problems, what's the solution? 1-800-639-2211. You can send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So, Scott Davidson, is it my imagination or are people driving faster on the interstate and even state roads than in previous years? I think there were 6 cases of drivers going over 100 miles an hour in the last month. What's going on out there?
Well, I think it's just what you're saying. Especially during the summer months, we see change in behavior. And one of those changes in behavior we do see is an increase in speed. The cars definitely pick up. The roads are clearer. We're traveling the highways. We're going on vacation. We're feeling good. And again, just due to road conditions, the speed is increasing. So that lends to a lot of different concerns. Again, during the summer months, we have work zones. So we're concerned about the safety of those working in those zones. We've had a lot of near collisions this year reported back through the Vermont Agency of Transportation from the workers. We had a fatality just last year in a work zone. We're seeing motorcycle fatalities this year again. Just the other vulnerable users on the road, bicycles. We saw 3 fatalities this year. And a lot of these, and not all of them, are related to speed. So speed is a top priority in the state of Vermont.
Do you think this situation is getting worse?
I think that's probably a better question for Lieutenant Scott with regards to statistics, if he does have those present. But definitely during the summer months, the speeds do increase.
So overall, we're seeing a downward trend in fatalities nationwide and in Vermont. Last year, we had the lowest number of fatalities that we've had since the 40s. But it's still not good enough. You know, this year we've seen an uptick. July and August have been particularly deadly months in Vermont. And speed is usually a contributing circumstance in all of that. But overall, I think we're getting a little bit better. There's, with the road engineering and manufacturing of vehicles, enforcement. And the big part is, another big part is the response of EMTs. We're doing a better job with all that. It's the education is one of the things we need to do a better job of overall, and the behavior of our drivers to let them know that these, when they engage in risky behavior, there's going to be deadly consequences, and it's not an accident. That's a negligent part of what they're doing. If you have a cell phone in your hand or you're in excess of the speed limit or you've consumed alcohol or drugs and you get behind the wheel, that's not an accident. That's negligence on that person. And time again, we see through crash investigations that's the factor that caused these things, and these are preventable tragedies.
Do you think alcohol is a factor in a lot of these excessive speeding cases?
We haven't seen that this year. And last year, we had 7 alcohol-related fatalities in our state, which was extremely low. And we saw for the first time an uptick in drugged driving fatalities. So that's a concern with us right now. We do have a serious opiate problem in the state right now, prescription pill problem. That carries over to people on the roadways. And when they get behind the wheel, just because they have received a prescription medication from their doctor doesn't necessarily mean they're okay to drive. And that's another education component of that we need to think about and get a, do a better job of relaying that message to patients. When they get behind the wheel, they have to make sure that they are okay to drive and that you can be processed just like a DUI with your prescription medication.
And Scott, we were talking about people, the six cases of people going 100 miles an hour and all a lot of people doing 85 and 90. It's not like this is happening at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's happening during the morning commute. It's happening in the afternoon commute. I mean, it's a very different situation if it's happening with a lot of cars on the road. Is that the problem, that people are endangering other people's lives as well?
Oh, absolutely. When you're driving at a speed of 100 miles an hour on the interstate, you don't have control of that vehicle. You can't make a split-second change in direction to avoid a collision. Or if a deer comes out in the middle of the road, a ball bounces in the road from a child, and you're changing direction at that type of speed, you just increase your risk of getting into a collision with another vehicle, a telephone pole, or any other type of object. And when we see these speed-related crashes, the difference between a crash at 20 miles an hour and a crash at 100 miles an hour is the difference between life or death. It's really that simple.
We've gotten a couple of emails, Lieutenant Scott. They're all sort of the same. Concerns about excessive speed and also tailgating. John wrote us, "My concern is less about the occasional 100-mile-per-hour driver and more about the thousands of people who are going 75, 85 every single day on the interstate. Many also push me right out of the passing lane, often 10 feet from my bumper. Try driving 65 on the interstate and you'll find every single car passes you and you pass no one." Avi wrote us, "People speeding is only half the problem. What I see every time I'm on the interstate between Montpelier and Burlington is people driving incredibly aggressively, tearing down the road to within a car length of the driver in front and essentially demanding or bullying their way." What about this aggressive driving behavior?
Absolutely. It is a problem. We recognize that it's a problem up there. And again, I think it comes back to the behavior. When people get behind the wheel of their car, there seems to be this feeling that they're invincible. They don't know the person that's next to them on the roadway. And if we could change that behavior to think about the people driving down the road, are your neighbors, are your friends, are your relatives, or someone riding a bicycle on the side of the road, to give them more space, because that is, could be someone from your neighborhood or a friend of a friend. And if we thought of it that way, I think we'd see a lot of times that people would give more space to the car that's in front of them, so you'd have a reactionary gap, so it wouldn't be so aggressive. They would reduce their speed. And so it really does come down to the behavior. I mean, we put a lot of things in place engineer-wise with safety of signs on the roads and centerline rumble strips, and a lot of those mechanisms are put into place, but we can't really tap into what the driver behavior is and why people become so aggressive behind the wheel. And once we can educate people to make them realize that you need to have safety measures in place, we can continue to try to drive down these terrible crashes.
And Scott, a lot of people have written in to say, yes, this is a problem on the interstate, but hey, it's a big problem on town roads as well and state roads. Is that what you're finding as well? You may have a road that's posted at 40 and somebody's doing 70, and that situation is every bit as bad, if not worse, than someone doing 85 on the interstate?
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at a neighborhood situation, my previous career, I was in law enforcement for 25 years. And as a area supervisor, a district supervisor within the city I worked, I would say a majority of the phone calls I received from the neighborhoods were around speed, stop signs, aggressive driving in the neighborhoods. In order to be successful, and it's one of those things I learned, is we can't ticket our way out of the problem. issuing tickets alone just isn't going to slow people down. It's a collaborative effort between engineering, enforcement, and education. I got to tell you, I used to drive through the city of Burlington, and they had these little red political signs, and they used to say, slow down. But that simple message alone, even when you're driving the speed limit, you see that sign, cognitively it sends off an alert, slow down. And you hit the brake and you slow down within the neighborhood. Or a roundabout put into a neighborhood, other traffic calming, bump outs, stuff like that, that just make the car slow down. So by just re-engineering a road, enforcing the speed limit, and providing that education and that reminder, things like the front porch forum, getting that message out within neighborhoods, reminding the neighbors to slow down. If you don't mind, I'll give you a quick story. I had a neighborhood that was complaining on a regular basis, calling the police department about an intersection that cars weren't stopping. So I met with the neighbors, I sat down, I spoke with them, and they described a situation that it was commuters coming from Colchester through Burlington going to work in the city. And it was also students. And they were saying that most of them were young of age, and this is who was running the stop sign. So we assigned officers to go down to the stop sign. They wrote a lot of tickets over a three-day period of time, and then I reported back to that same group. What was interesting is none of the addresses on the tickets that we wrote were Colchester. They were Burlington residents. In fact, they were neighbors. In fact, they lived in the neighborhood in which they lived, in which these other neighbors were concerned about what was happening. And they weren't students. The age category were the responsible adults that were sitting in front of me telling me about the problem in their own neighborhood. So it's all of us. It's not somebody else that's speeding. It's us. It's Vermonters, it's our community, it's our responsibility. And getting that message out and reminding each other to slow down is really what's important.
Let's go to our callers. A lot of people are interested in weighing in on this subject, so let's start with Ken, who's calling from Fairfield. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thanks. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Yes. What's on your mind today, Ken?
Well, when I commute quite a bit going across the 89 bridge across the Lamoille River in Milton, and of course that's a construction zone, and I noticed that even after hours, people are not slowing down. Now, I know it's been mentioned that we can't ticket our way out of this issue, but isn't that a lot of lost revenue for the state as well as, you know, trying to get people to slow down there?
It's a great question. Enforcement, Lieutenant Scott, you know, if people think that they might get caught, will they speed less?
No. I think that we see that when, you know, when they see the cruiser there, people behave better. But then they speed right back up again as soon as it's out of sight. So AOT has contracts with law enforcement to work in the work zones to have speed enforcement. If we're there for a few days, people will slow down. But as soon as we're gone, the speeds pick back up again, and it's unfortunate. There's plenty of signage we've got up there, and the Waterbury area is a good one now where we've put a lot of effort into that at Exit 10. Of having large signs up there. They have the flashing speed signs that come back at you. And we've seen a slight reduction in speeds there, but it's still early, you know, before they get to the work zone, they've still seen speeds in excess of 75 miles an hour southbound into that work zone. So it's a difficult problem, but it's on our radar, and we're trying to do a better job of getting out there because we don't want to see anyone be injured and then or just have a crash that creates, you know, significant tie-ups for traffic, and that bleeds over to Route 100 up to Stowe and to Waterbury Village. So we recognize it. We're trying to do a better job. We do have enforcement efforts going out there, and we do have data that comes back to us to show us that these speeds are there. It's just a matter of being there at the right time and trying to get people to slow down.
So what I hear both of you saying is enforcement by itself is not the answer. Is that correct?
That's exactly. Correct. Yeah. Yes.
And that there has to be an educational component to this?
Correct.
And it's everything together. You know, education, design of roads. If it's a wide open road and the speed limit's 25 miles an hour, but people feel comfortable driving 50, they're gonna pick up the speed. So we got to try to have traffic calming procedures put into place in a road to make it the speed limit. A lot of times we hear from communities saying, everyone's driving so fast by our house, and we want the speed limit reduced to 25 miles an hour. And if you just reduce the speed limit, people are still going to drive the speed they feel comfortable at. And that creates a problem for law enforcement because you have every car going 40, 45 miles an hour, and now you're selectively enforcing, and it doesn't work. And then you have the person that's driving 25 and someone coming up behind them at 40 miles an hour, and we have collisions. You know, so it has to have everything working together, and it can't just be one thing that solves this problem.
Let's talk to Beth Ann, who's calling from East Montpelier. Hi, Beth Ann. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Good morning.
So what's on your mind today?
Well, we're talking about cell phones and handheld and the laws against them, and I'm really concerned about other things that cause a major distraction. And I noticed that, I mean, I'm a dog lover. I love my dog. I take my dog a lot in doing my errands. And there's a lot of dogs jumping around the front seats, mostly smaller dogs, and that to me is 20 times the distraction to a cell phone or any other handheld iPhone, iPod. So I'm wondering about small dogs in the front seat, especially on drivers' laps and looking out the windows. Wondering if we're paying any attention to that. Thanks.
Lieutenant Scott, everybody sees someone driving down the road with a little dog in the front. It's almost like the little dog has their paws on the steering wheel. What about that?
Yeah, so there is laws about obstruction of your windshield, and so that kind of comes down to officer discretion of how that is working. But I agree with the caller that the animal moving around the front of the car while you're trying to drive it, if it falls down into your by your feet and gets entangled in the gas pedal, the brakes, that's going to create a very serious situation. And again, people need to be responsible. That's bad behavior right there. And, you know, having a loose animal in the car up in front with you is not a safe way to be driving down the car just because you want to pet it or you love your animal. You got to take responsibility for that, put the animal in the back. And then it comes to – so the ticketing process of that is not crystal clear. But if it is obstructing or it is hindering the operator in a way, they can be ticketed for it.
Let's turn to Hunter in Williston. Hi, Hunter. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I was curious if you could address the research showing that raising speed limits doesn't increase accidents or even speeding in general.
Lieutenant Scott, you're looking quizzically here. Hunter, what studies are these?
I mean, Google it quickly. They're all over the place. I have one pulled up right now. Bear with me a second. This is a study by the U.S. Department of Transportation, Federal Highway Administration, and the last line of the first paragraph says, conversely, raising posted speed limits does not increase or accidents.
So what we do at the Agency of Transportation is generally we have speed studies that are done, and they will send in engineers to take a look at what the posted speed limit is in the area, what is the speed survey showing us for the average speed of vehicles in there, and then we take a look at all the crash data that's involved in that area. So it's a sort of combined effort on all these different fronts to see what is the safest speed, what are people traveling, what can the road handle. So that's, I think, following the question is sometimes we have communities that say we need to have the speed limit at this without having any data to support it. And what we're doing in Vermont is to make sure we have data to support what speed limits are posted in certain areas so we can have a safe speed and people understand what those limits are. And some of the things we're talking about by, you know, maybe narrowing the road or widening the road, having rumble strips in areas, and having consistency. So Route 4 from the interstate over towards Killington was an area a few years ago. We had a high number of collisions and fatality collisions. And we went in as an alliance, the Vermont Highway Safety Alliance, to look at what can we do as a whole group, and having private industry and Agency of Transportation, law enforcement, all look at what can be done through there to create a consistency of speed, a consistency of signage, and that's the whole thing we want to look at. Just the speed limit alone isn't going to work because, as I said earlier, people are going to drive a speed that they feel comfortable at, regardless of what the posted speed limit is. So we have to have all of these things working together to reduce that speed or make it a safe speed.
Today in the program, we're looking at a variety of highway safety issues. What are your thoughts? 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. We're looking at highway safety in Vermont today. Our guest, Lieutenant Gary Scott, the head of Vermont State Police Traffic Safety Team, and Scott Davidson, who's the chief of the Governor's Highway Safety Program. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Let's turn to Julia, who is calling from North Chittenden. Hi, Julia. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for having me on. First, I'll just say I spend a lot of time on the road all over Rutland County for my job. I have for a couple of years now, well, several years on and off. And so, you know, when you're talking about what do I see out there on the road, I would have to say just all of the above. One just quick comment. I've noticed that to post one of those electronic speed signs, you know, at the entrance to villages is quite effective. People on Route 3 going between Rutland and Proctor, you know, they're zipping along at 50. Suddenly they have to go down to 25. And once they notice what their speed is on that electronic sign, they will drop their speed, including me. So that's effective. But my main question is, we're talking about distracted driving with handheld devices. We're talking about driving under the influence of alcohol. My question has to do with drug impairment. And it's a dual question, really. First of all, what does Lieutenant Scott anticipate the challenges to the state police would be if recreational marijuana were legalized in Vermont? And the second question is, how close are we to getting a reliable roadside test for driving high? Thank you.
All right, that's a great question, and maybe we could expand it out a little bit, Lieutenant Scott, because you talked about a prescription drug impairment mm-hmm. earlier. How do you test for that?
So we've had a program in Vermont since 2005, the Drug Recognition Program, which is DRE is the short acronym for it. We have about 36 officers statewide. That's local sheriffs, DMV inspectors, and state troopers that are specially trained to detect a person that's under the influence of something other than alcohol. So the scenario would be if a person is driving erratically or is involved in a collision, an officer shows up and recognizes there's some level of impairment there and it's not alcohol related, they can call a DRE in to assist in the investigation. The DRE does a 12-step process, and usually at the end we're looking to do a blood draw. And that blood draw right now goes out of state. We don't have the ability to do completely all the drug testing right here in Vermont. And that the business we send it to is a business, and they have a business model, and they can have multiple chemists working on it and toxicologists to work on that. So it's expensive for us to send these out, and that's an issue for us right now. Another part is that we're looking at we introduced legislation last session for saliva testing. There is technology out there that is relatively new to help screen for a certain number of drugs that are out there on someone. So there is the ability to do it, to have sort of that preliminary breath test where we do now with alcohol. We need to get there completely with where we can swab someone and determine what type of drug they're under. But we really are looking at the impairment. We want to make sure that the person has a describable or articulable amount of impairment before we move into that process where we're going to ask for a sample of their saliva or anything like that. So we have programs in place, and I think Scott can talk about the A-Ride program a little bit, which is going to, which is now being mandated to every law enforcement officer in the state.
Well, there's a couple pieces I guess I'd like to talk about with regard to that. Is I don't know if we're going to have recreational marijuana use legalized. We don't know. But what we do know is we have to be prepared. One of those things is preparing law enforcement. When we go to the police academy, you learn so much about alcohol and the processing of alcohol, impaired drivers, and you don't get as much with the drug-related. It's much more complicated. It's much more in-depth. One of the things that the Criminal Justice Training Council, that's the group of folks that actually train our police officers and certify them, actually are now requiring that all police officers that graduate from the academy have A-Ride training. A-Ride is
Advanced Roadside Impairment Detection Enforcement.
There we go. And it gives the officers the tools to be able to detect folks that are impaired by drug instead of alcohol. And really the next piece here, too, is really to remind Vermonters. And we have two ads that are going to be coming out here in the next month or so. One specific to drug-impaired driving, and it's going to remind folks that if you drive impaired, even to the slightest degree, it's DUI, and you can be arrested. And the second piece that we're going to talk about is prescriptions. That's going to be the next ad. And that ad is going to remind folks that those warning labels do include motor vehicles and driving under the influence of a substance that impairs your driving, even if it's a prescription, whether it's Percocet, whether it's an anti-anxiety drug. If doctor or pharmacist tells you you shouldn't be driving a motor vehicle, you shouldn't be driving a motor vehicle.
So right now in Vermont, we've had 35 fatalities, and of that, six of those people, operators, are suspected of being under the influence of alcohol only. We also have six people that are under the influence of cannabis, so that's even. And last year we saw for the first time where drugged drivers surpassed alcohol drivers. So we had seven alcohol-related fatalities last year, and we had 12 drugged driver fatalities. So we're seeing an upward trend. The technology needs to catch up where we can have the ability to test and prosecute these cases successfully in the state.
Let's turn to Christina, who's calling from Lindenville. Hi, Christina. What's on your mind today?
I spent 3 years in Boston and going to school, and the first rule of thumb I learned was if I was going to get on 95 or any of the other traffic use highways in Boston, I was to go with the flow no matter what the speed was. Because if you didn't, it would slow you down, and you would slow others down, and you would be in danger of creating an accident. And I'm wondering how many folks who are around now have had that experience. And with the extra traffic that we have on the highways, if that's one of the theories behind people traveling faster. Just a thought.
Well, I grew up in Boston also, so I learned how to drive. I think one of the things they taught us, too, was not to use our blinker, if I remember correctly. But joking aside, is that we need to make sure we have a consistent speed limit. And that is a factor we see out there. People, if they are staying at a steady flow, that keeps traffic moving and making sure that that's the right speed limit for that area. It really, again, comes down to driver behavior. Down in Boston, we see just, you know, when you drive down there, you see people cutting from lane to lane and all different behavior, and it's very stressful. And that's, fortunately, we don't have four-lane highways in Vermont. There are two lanes, and it's pretty tight. But it does create some traffic backups at times. So we need to just be safe out there and make sure we're driving at an appropriate speed.
We got this email from Andy who wrote, I drive a commercial vehicle, a tractor trailer, for a living, so I'm out on the roads every day trying to earn a living. While excessive speeding is a major issue on the road, so is cutting vehicles off when passing them and passing on the right. From what I see, passing on the right is as big an issue as excessive speeding. Lieutenant Scott, is that true?
Yes. You know, what people, a lot of times we see people in the outside lane, if they're not passing anyone, they should be moving back over to the travel lane or the right lane. If they're being passed on the right, there's a number of problems in there, and that's not, people aren't expecting to be passed on the right, so they're moving with the flow and they're going to make their maneuver back to the right lane, and someone comes up fast on them and cuts that lane and cuts back over. It's extremely dangerous, because drivers aren't prepared for that. They're not expecting someone to come up behind them and try to pass them into the right or go into the shoulder to get around them as well. So it's a very dangerous maneuver, and it's something we don't want to see happen out there. But we also want to make sure people aren't just sitting outside in that left lane and driving down the interstate. After you make your pass and get by a vehicle, you should be moving right back into the travel lane.
Scott, I'm kind of wondering, you look at some new cars, and they have huge consoles now in the front. That could be your GPS. It could be giving you all sorts of other information. Do you think that this is a safety concern, people taking their eye off the road, looking at the console, looking back at the road? Are you finding this to be a problem?
Well, I don't know if any of you out here have been calling in, on hands-free, but I went and bought a Bluetooth to put in my car that mounts up on the visor. And, you know, I read the directions. I went through it, and I'm probably not the most technically savvy person. I have my 9-year-old daughter in the car with me, and I wanted to impress her to show her this new technology. I said, watch how this works. All I got to do is say, call, and we'll call your sister. So I said, call Ashley. And I have one song recorded on my phone, one, and it's Black Betty, because it's my 9-year-old's favorite song. So somehow I said, call Ashley, and Black Betty started to play on my Bluetooth. So next thing you know, I'm pushing buttons and trying to figure out what I'm doing. Clearly, by doing so, I'm not paying attention to what I'm doing. If you're going to drive a car, drive the car. Focus on the road, focus on what's in front of you, and focus on the operation of the vehicle and not on all the electronics. Whatever that call was, it could wait. Whatever that text was, it can wait. And that's the message we really want to send folks, is to just wait until your ride's over and then make your phone call.
Let's talk to Lanny, who's calling from Hartford. Hi, Lanny. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is that, there's no excuse for distracted driving. With the advances in technology of automobiles, you have vehicles on the road nowadays that are safer with airbags and with sway control and with all these safety advances, and they're all great. But with that comes also, people don't realize how fast they're going sometimes because the handling of these vehicles are so much easier. How much do we have to go back and blame the actual manufacturers of these vehicles for the excessive speed? That would be my question. And has the Governor's Safety Council or anyone within the government thought about going to vehicle manufacturers and saying, you know, your advances are great for safety-wise, but we have to think about the speed aspect as well?
Yeah, so that's driven by the market, you know, what customers want. And so that's, you know, they're in the business to make money a lot of times, so, and they are working to be safe. But people do want that high-quality car. And so that's something that's a line that the manufacturers do have to walk. And, you know, when we do have serious crashes, the manufacturers do review the crash reports to take a look at them and how they can improve safety features. But I agree, the cars do handle much better, obviously. They can maneuver much better. But, again, it comes back down to the driver behavior. You are driving that car. You know how fast you're going in it. You know when you're passing someone, you're going by them, that you're in excess of the speed limit. So it comes right back to, you know, accountability. We have to make sure that we are paying attention to what we're doing on the roadway, and it really shouldn't be – we can't deflect it somewhere else, but we do have technology that we can rely on to help us be safer drivers. But at the end of the day, it's each person has to be responsible for their actions.
Let's talk to Jason, who's calling from Burlington. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call. I work for Local Motion in Burlington, and we think about this issue from the perspective of safety for people who are walking and biking. So it's a subset of what you're talking about for sure. One thing that we see over and over is a tension between a desire to make streets wide in order to accommodate emergency vehicles and ensure rapid response when a fire truck needs to get somewhere. And the fact that those wide streets then mean that people are encouraged to speed the 99.9% of the time that a fire truck is not going down a given street. And I'm curious if your guests can share any thoughts on how these distinct, equally important, but sometimes competing needs for how we design our roads are being addressed here in Vermont.
Well, I know from talking to engineers at V-Trans about this very topic, is just to give you an idea, it costs to add a foot width onto a roadway, it's $1 million a mile by the time they put the sure pack down and, you know, they put the pavement. So it's a pretty expensive proposition to widen the roads. But what they have been doing is they've been narrowing the traveled portion of the roadways, which then gives you more room in the breakdown lane for bicycles, pedestrian traffic, and other vulnerable users.
Well, this whole issue of highway safety is very relevant this Labor Day weekend. Many thanks to our guest today, Scott Davidson of the Governor's Highway Safety Program, and Lieutenant Gary Scott of the Vermont State Police Traffic Safety Team. We really appreciate you coming by. A great program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up next, I'll talk with retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis about important developments this week in both Vermont and national political scenes. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. It's been a big week for political news, both at the state and national level. Vermont has two new gubernatorial candidates, and Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders continues to pick up support for his campaign. With us now to look at these developments is retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis. Hi, Eric. Great to have you on the show.
Good afternoon, Bob.
So, Eric, let's start with the presidential race. A new poll from Iowa showed Bernie Sanders closing the gap with Hillary Clinton. A few months ago, Clinton led Sanders by roughly 40 points. Now the difference is down to 7. What's going on here? Why is Sanders doing so well? And why does Clinton's support seem to be fading?
Well, I think there's two interesting findings in this poll, which was done by Bloomberg News and the Des Moines Register. First of all, a very high percentage of Iowans say that they're looking for someone outside the established political system. Only 16% of likely Democratic caucus voters said they were happy or satisfied with politicians in general. So Sanders' outsider message, even though he's been in Congress for a very long time, his criticism of the political establishment and his argument that he presents a new perspective certainly has an appeal to Iowa voters. And then secondly, Hillary Clinton has her own problems, in part because of the relentless news coverage of the email issues, in part because of her reluctance to hold press conferences, mingle with ordinary voters, and so forth. So her approval in that Iowa poll is below 50%, which is the first time that poll has found that she has more people disapproving her than approving her.
And when you look at that level of dissatisfaction among Iowa voters, is that higher this year than in previous years?
Yes, and it's not just on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, the strong showing of outsider candidates like Donald Trump and Ben Carson in Iowa is a reflection of the same thing. Voters are just very dissatisfied with the political system and are gravitating toward candidates who are making outsider arguments, almost anti-system arguments in some cases, although that's more on the Republican side than the Sanders campaign.
So do you think these voters are going to want to send a message when it comes time for the Iowa caucuses?
It may be. And one of the things we see in previous elections, in primaries and caucuses, especially the early states like Iowa and New Hampshire, is that sometimes when voters make their choices in those elections, they do it not necessarily choosing the person they want to be president of the United States, but taking advantage of the media attention that these early state events get to send a message through their voting. And voting for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary or Donald Trump or Ben Carson in the Republican primary is a way of sending a message that we're dissatisfied with the way the system works and we're looking for something new.
Eric, let's take a look at Vermont's gubernatorial race now. This week, businessman Bruce Lissman, one of the co-founders of the Campaign for Vermont, announced he would be seeking the Republican nomination. Many political observers think that Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott will also be seeking the GOP nomination. Now, Lissman has never run for public office before. What are some of the challenges that he might face in a primary contest with Phil Scott?
Well, first of all, Phil Scott is very well known. He's been in the Senate for 10 years and lieutenant governor now for 3 terms. He's very popular. He's done very well in the last several elections. And one thing Phil Scott has going for him is that in the last presidential year in 2012, Phil Scott was reelected comfortably with close to 60% of the vote in the same election in which, at the top of the ballot, Barack Obama and Bernie Sanders and Peter Welch all got between 60 and 70% of the vote. So Scott has a demonstrated ability to attract votes from ticket-splitting voters. And Lissman will need to convince Republican primary voters that if he were to win the Republican primary, he could then go on to win a general election in a year in which, higher up on the ballot, the Democratic nominee, whoever it is, Senator Leahy, who's running for re-election this year, and Representative Welch are likely to do very well. So that's one of Lissman's challenges. The other is that the Republican Party in Vermont tends to sort of look at a promotion up the line system. If you look back historically, you've seen that often Republicans have chosen as their gubernatorial candidates, especially in open seat years, people who have been lieutenant governor or other lower statewide offices like treasurer or secretary of state, or people who've had leadership positions in the legislature. And Bruce Lisman, if he were elected governor, would be the first person with no political experience to be elected since Dean Davis back in 1968. And again, I think Lisman is going to have some difficulties convincing voters that they should choose a newcomer rather than the more familiar figure of Phil Scott. Also, the Vermont Republican Party has spent a lot of time in the last few years trying to position itself as the voice of hard-pressed middle-income Vermont families. And Phil Scott has a strong appeal to that constituency. And it's going to take some work for Bruce Lisman to match that appeal, particularly in the more rural parts of the state, in the Northeast Kingdom, in parts of Rutland County, in parts of central Vermont, where Republicans have traditionally done well in general election campaigns.
Let's take a look at the Democratic side. It was no big surprise this week that former Windsor County Senator Matt Dunne officially announced he's running for governor. He's raised roughly $200,000 this summer for this race, so we have at least a two-person primary because House Speaker Shap Smith is also in the race. So what does a Smith-Dunne primary contest look like?
To me, Bob, it looks like it would be a very competitive election. Both of them come into the race with advantages, and both of them face challenges. Smith is certainly well-known in Montpelier and among Democratic activists around the state, and he'll have support from local legislators all around the state, which can certainly help. But one of his challenges in the Democratic primary is going to be that progressives aren't particularly enamored of him. Some progressives think the legislature has not adequately funded human services programs in recent years and that the tax system needs to be made more progressive. Dunne has run statewide before, so has a network of supporters in place. And I think the thing that Dunne will try and hang his campaign on, or one of the major themes he'll use this year, is that he's been outside of Montpelier for a while. He hasn't really been part of Vermont's political scene for the last 6 years or so. And we know from what we were talking about earlier with Iowa and in Vermont as well, there's a dissatisfaction with politics as usual. So I think Dunne will say that as a relative outsider, he can bring new perspectives and innovative ideas to the political discussion. One of his challenges is going to be convincing voters that if he wins the Democratic primary, he could then win the general election, particularly if Phil Scott ends up as the Republican nominee. So Matt Dunne needs to convince voters that he's learned the lessons of his two previous defeats for statewide office and would do better this year if he were to win the Democratic primary.
So do you think that dissatisfaction of voters that we see at the national level is also taking place at the state level?
Yes, it's here, but it may not be as intense, and it may not be reflected in the more virulent forms we're seeing in other states. But I think there is a concern in terms of perhaps state government overpromising and not delivering. I think Vermont Health Connect is a good example. There's certainly continued concern about the level of taxes, and particularly property tax bills, and that may rise this fall as property tax bills start to go out. So there are concerns. Granted, the political system in Vermont is closer to the voters than in many other states. The legislature is, and legislative districts are relatively small. But recognizing public discontent with politics as usual is something that would probably work to candidates' advantages.
There could be a third person in that race. Transportation Secretary Sue Minter says she's seriously looking at running for governor, running for the Democratic nomination. What are the chances, do you think, that she'll run?
I'm not sure, Bob, because of two concerns. One is that if that she were to become a candidate, she'd have to resign as Transportation Secretary immediately because state law forbids people in senior executive positions from raising money while they're holding those offices. And I'm not sure if she wants to do that in terms of her own career. More importantly, I could see her being asked to stay on by whoever is elected governor next year. I think this is since she's done a good job in the Agency of Transportation, now as secretary, formerly as deputy. She works with a lot of local governments around the state, as well as federal officials that provide a lot of transportation funding. And I could see if one of the other two Democrats were elected governor, he asking Sue Minta to stay on as Secretary of Transportation. And if Phil Scott were elected governor, I could see the possibility that he might ask Sue Minta to stay on. So she needs to think about her career, and she'd be starting later than the other two candidates. So there's a lot of things she'll need to take into consideration in making the decision whether to run. She would, of course, be the only woman in the race. And I know there's a lot of pressure that's coming from more senior women who would like to see a woman governor. Remember, we haven't had one since Madeline Cunin, and Governor Cunin herself is one of the people who's been urging Sue Minta to get into the race.
We'll be following all of these developments in the coming weeks and months. Retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis, many thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure, Bob.
That's Vermont Edition for today. Vermont Edition is taking Labor Day off, but we hope you'll make a point of tuning in on Tuesday for a special program when Vermont Edition goes to the Champlain Valley Fair. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sangari, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.